Downtown's Andrew Jackson statue was vandalized twice in 1 week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we'll take your calls as the Jackson statue and other Confederate monuments across the South are tagged with the phrase Black Lives Matter. We want your calls and thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, a new study out of Flagler College looking at the risks of texting while driving, plus best-selling author Marja Mills on her unlikely friendship with the great Harper Lee. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, lots of reaction after downtown Jacksonville's Andrew Jackson statue has been vandalized twice in a week. This city, of course, is named for Jackson, who never actually visited here. Now, someone tagged the base of the statue on Sunday with the phrase Black Lives Matter and Justice for D before the words were pressure washed off. On June 30th, someone also put a Native American mask on the statue. Jackson, of course, was the president who signed the Indian Removal Act of 1830 into law, leading to thousands of natives leaving their ancestral lands for reservations west of the Mississippi, that historic event known as the Trail of Tears. Confederate monuments all over the South have been tagged with Black Lives Matter recently. This as South Carolina lawmakers vote this week on whether to remove the Confederate flag from their state's Capitol grounds. Joining us now to discuss all of this, we welcome by phone Sierra Taylor of the activist group The Dream Defenders. Good morning, Sierra.
Good morning.
And joining us here in studio, Emily Liska, who runs the Jacksonville Historical Society. Hi, Emily.
Good morning, Melissa.
And we want your calls as we discuss the vandalizing of downtown Jacksonville's Andrew Jackson statue. What are your thoughts and comments? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And we're already getting a lot of your comments on Facebook. We'll get to those in just a moment. Sierra Taylor, let's begin with you. The hashtag Black Lives Matter, very popular on Twitter, and it's also now turning up at Confederate monuments in states all over the South, not just here in Jacksonville. What are your thoughts?
I think this is very this is very interesting, and we live in very interesting times. For me, what I think is most interesting is people's attention to these symbols, like the symbols of the Confederacy, with the flag, with Andrew Jackson, and the Black Lives Matter movement, which is growing and widely spreading not only in the United States but around the world, which to me is an important movement because it is really about the humanization of Black people, in this country and around the world. And it's an exclamation of humanity and the need for the acknowledgement and recognition of the humanity of Black people who are often treated horribly in this country especially. And so it's really interesting that Justice for D was tagged on the Andrew Jackson statue, because he was killed by police officers, which is something that has been a big issue within the Black Lives Matter movement. And then we see in our country that already this year, 573 people in the United States have been killed at the hands of law enforcement. The way in which the Black Lives Matter movement is tying in recent events and occurrences with historical precedents that were set, I think it's a learning learning moment for everyone.
And it's 549-2937 to join the show. The Justice for D graffiti appears to refer to, as you said, D'Angelo Stallworth, who was killed in the city in a police-involved shooting that is under investigation. Let me ask you as a follow-up. Those who've criticized this tagging of Confederate monuments have said that it's still wrong to deface a public monument, even if the cause is just. What about that argument?
I think for me, when it comes to tagging or vandalism, I think for me, I always pay attention to what people care more about. And especially in the case of D'Angelo Stallworth, it seems as though there is more of an uproar about the fact that Justice for D was tagged on Andrew Jackson's statue than there has been for the fact that he was killed by law enforcement. And, you know, the situation regarding that event is still very unclear with conflicting autopsy reports with the police investigation.
And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment. We're getting lots of emails and tweets and Facebook comments, too. The number to join the show is 549-2937. Let's turn now to Emily Liska of the Jacksonville Historical Society. Of course, Emily, that big statue of Andrew Jackson in downtown Jacksonville is quite prominent. This city was named after Andrew Jackson, the former president. And in addition to the graffiti, someone also a week before put a Native American mask over the statue, a reference to Jackson's signing of the Indian Removal Act into law. There's a complicated history with Andrew Jackson that you have a lot to share.
Yeah, very complicated history. And it all, you know, it harkens back first to the fact that we named our city for a general. He was yet to be elected president. That would come about 7 years later. Now, by that time, he was already a hero, a rock star, if you may, probably the greatest rock star in the U.S. at that time. He was known for his West Florida and Alabama Indian removals and wars. He was known, of course, as the great hero of the Battle of New Orleans, the final whipping of the British. And he had his own angst with the British that was very deep and personal, but that was that final blow. So the great rock star persona, a man who lived in the area where Jacksonville was found, his name was John Warren, not in the city proper, but when the town of Jacksonville was founded, he would suggest the name Jackson because he had fought under Old Hickory. And indeed, the name of honor was said.
That was Jackson's nickname.
It was.
Old Hickory.
Oh, because he was as tough as a hickory tree or hickory stick. His troops had named him that during the War of 1812 because they saw that Jackson was willing to suffer as they were, as they would put it. He was a tough guy. Jacksonville would thrive. Our immediate streets are a story of early American history and the story of America at the time Jacksonville was founded. So there's never actually a town of Calford, as people like to say, but from the get-go, we were called Jacksonville, and it was from that day. In fact, it was exactly 11 months after Florida became a territory of the U.S., Jacksonville then would be founded because settlers felt safe coming here. They felt they'd be protected by the U.S.
Jackson is more associated with the Trail of Tears, the Indian removal, than perhaps slavery. What are your thoughts, though, about the Jackson Monument being tagged along with other monuments all over states that have these statues celebrating figures from the old Confederacy? Is it because Jackson, we tend to think of him as more as being more tied to the tragedy involving Native Americans. What are your thoughts?
Well, history is history is history, and I am highly sympathetic with the social justice statements being made. But my thoughts are it's defacement, and it's a piece of the city's history, good, bad, or indifferent. That is it. But I also agree with your guest today that, you know, goodness, isn't it a shame? This is what it takes to get the publicity that might be needed. So I see both sides of this, but certainly as an active participant in the history community, I want to protect our pieces of history, and that includes our outdoor statues.
And Sierra Taylor, as we talk about this, as we speak, lawmakers in South Carolina are voting on whether to take down the Confederate flag from their Capitol grounds. This after the massacre at an historically African-American AME church in Charleston. The South Carolina Senate already voting overwhelmingly to do so. Now we will wait and see what the South Carolina House does. The ripple effects from that tragedy in Charleston we're seeing in many other locales, including here in Jacksonville.
Yes. So as I reflect on everything that is going on around surrounding the controversy of the Confederate flag, I'm drawn to the words of President Obama. And, you know, he and I don't really see eye to eye on most things, but I think that his statement, you know, in saying removing the flag from the state's capital would not be an act of political correctness. It would not be an insult to the valor of Confederate soldiers. It would simply be an acknowledgement that the cause for which they fought, the cause of slavery, was wrong. And I find those words to be very important because, you know, I'm also a big fan of history, and I'm also a proud resident of, you know, a Southern state, and I have Southern pride. In the same vein, we have these symbols that illustrate the terror and the horror that was inflicted by the same people who bore these flags so long ago. And so, yes, we think about the Indian Removal Act or the Trail of Tears under Andrew Jackson, and I think we talk about it so passively, and we talk about it, you know, as though it was this humane act, as though these indigenous people who resided in the South just decided, you know, hey, this land, you know, you all can have it. We'll just move west. But that's not how it was. It was a genocide. It was the extermination of these people who had no other alternative to death than to move. And in the same vein, you know, Andrew Jackson, you know, who has been referred to as a rock star on the show, you know, this rock star owned up to 300 enslaved Africans. You know, we talk about him as, you know, this great leader, this great figure who protected those under his presidency or even under him as he was a general. But what about the people that he didn't protect? What about those people? And what about the fact that the same people that he committed acts of genocide on, you know, during his time in his position are the same people who are being mistreated and, you know, there's a certain extermination of these same people today?
Let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Ken in Jacksonville. Hey, Ken, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing, Karen?
Doing great, thanks.
Great. Two quick things. Number one, there's cameras all around Hemming Park. The ends never justifies the means. Has these criminals been caught, and are they being prosecuted? And number two, the slavery and more recently things like the Tuskegee experiment was done under the guise of the American flag. So when do we take it down and put it in?
That's Ken in Jacksonville. Sierra Taylor and then Emily.
I think it's really interesting that you bring up slavery and mostly the Tuskegee experiments, because when we talk about these symbols, like the Confederate flag symbol, and the debate over whether to remove them or not, you know, I can't help but to think about, you know, in Europe and paraphernalia relating to the Nazis, you know, the Gestapo, the SS, you don't see these symbols still flying high in the sky after what they did to so many people, not just Jewish people, but also people with mental illnesses or different sexual orientations or other minority groups in Europe. You don't see that. And the Tuskegee experiment was an evolution of practices that came from slavery, those same eugenic practices that they used in Europe that we find so atrocious today. And there still isn't the same retribution that we had, you know, for the people who were harmed under the Nazi empire as we do for people of color who were terrorized under those with a Confederate flag. I think that to discuss the American flag is a completely different subject that I would be definitely willing to think about and to discuss more in the future.
Emily Liska.
You know, I'll remark on Andrew Jackson. You know, I'm here to admit he was beloved and reviled. in his own lifetime and clearly since, based on the callers, the conversations, we know that. I have to say, as exec director of the Jacksonville Historical Society, I've had a tough time getting the story of Andrew Jackson out there. I've written grants to present exhibits, to present the story of Jackson, the good, the bad, the ugly, and have a little tough time getting funders.
And that is because of the controversy attached to Jackson's name?
I think, of course, so. And I have to congratulate groups like the Dream Defenders. At least they're able to get the story out there. We've had a little bit of a struggle doing that.
You want to tell the full story, warts and all.
Absolutely.
You feel that's your duty to history.
It is our duty. We did have one small hurrah when Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
The play.
Yes, the play, and actually the rock musical at Players by the Sea. So they invited the Jacksonville Historical Society to create an exhibit for that, and indeed we did. And it really received much acclaim, and it showed it all. It put it out there.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll get to your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments in just a minute on this very hot topic on the show today. Sarah in Jacksonville. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. It's interesting that you brought up the rock star aspect of this debate, because I think we're watching a cultural shift from, you know, this cult of personality, which is one based on dominance, whether it's colonialism or, you know, Andrew Jackson as a point person for extermination, to one of upholding the common good that would be all-inclusive of people of color and people of, you know, gender bias, as well as what we defend as, you know, sacred, which is our own personalities, rather than upholding just that one personality. And I think Andrew Jackson represented, a pinnacle in the belief system of America, which needs to change.
That's Sarah. Sarah in Jacksonville, thanks for calling. And tweets coming in. Here's one from a listener. Black Lives Matter is the right message. Jackson is the wrong target. It should have gone up at Confederate Park on Main Street. Here's another tweet.
I need to respond.
I know you want to. Every Confederate statue and plaque on public property should be ground into dust and melted for scrap. Sierra Taylor, there have been calls, especially in other states, not so much here in Florida, but in other states, to take down some of these statues and monuments. Do you agree with those calls?
Of course I agree with the calls. I think that the only thing that I disagree with is the narrowed in attention to these symbols. You know, Andrew Jackson didn't go into the church in South Carolina and shoot those 9 people. The Confederate flag didn't go into the church and shoot those 9 people. It was someone with a very skewed version of history and a very sinister understanding of race who went in and shot those people. And I think that our focus needs to be on providing accurate history for everyone in this country. So that involves, you know, definitely investing more into our education system. And it also involves us as a society in this country having a real conversation about race. Because once again, an event that was clearly based around racism is now being talked about through the means of these symbols and these statues and these monuments. But the real problem here are the actual racist beliefs that I think that we need to really delve into as a nation.
And here's another point of view on Twitter from Yancey. I am legally and genetically classified Cherokee. If anyone has a complaint, it would be me, and I don't. What, are we supposed to rename the city next?
Well,
Emily Liska.
There's where I was going. I think it's disingenuous to suggest that we take down any Confederate-related statue and not deal with the issue of our city's name. That is the ultimate symbol of the city, its name. And, of course, that's not a decision by a historical society or any individual. That is a city decision and a lawmaker's decision. But what I would say is I think we need to protect all of our outdoor art, including the art that's Confederate related. And I'd like to make mention of that Confederate statue. It was dedicated in 1898, and General Grant's grandson, some 30 years plus after the Civil War, came down for that dedication. And that he was here to show
this
his
respect. This is the one in Confederate Park?
Absolutely. The one in Hemming
the
Park.
The one in Hemming Park.
Hemming Park.
Yeah. And Dave in Riverside emails the show, what is the story of Hemming Park? Who was Charles Hemming? He was a Civil War general.
He was not.
No.
He mustered in out of Jacksonville as a private into the Civil War. And when the war was over, made good money in banking in Texas, and decided he would purchase for Jacksonville this Confederate marker. At the time, U.S. Congress had promoted this idea through resolution that memorials would be placed in the U.S. for both Northern and Southern soldiers, etc., in all parts of the U.S., and indeed, we were a part of that movement. The city council at the time was so overwhelmed by the gift, they renamed the park, which at that point was called St. James Park, to Hemming Park.
And lots of comments on our Facebook page. Vandalizing and destroying public monuments is not the right way to correct historical wrongs. Instead, let's come up with a peaceful solution similar to the discussions in South Carolina about the Confederate flag. Dan on Facebook, clearly they are confusing Jackson as a Confederate general. He wasn't. He was a slaveholder, but so was Washington, Jefferson, and many others. Sierra Taylor, that gets to the very root of our tangled history with this issue. The men who founded this nation all were slaveholders.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that, like I said, I think that's a conversation that we should be having, is about this country's history in relation to people of color, especially those who were affected by the slavery that ran rampant in this country. And the Facebook commenter made a very good point that Andrew Jackson wasn't a part of the Confederacy. And I actually, he threatened military force against those who were attempting to secede from the Union. And so, like I said, for me, the issue is not these symbols. It's not the statues. It's not the monuments. My issue is with the racist ideology that is still taking hold of the hearts and minds of people in this country. And I think that is holding us back from really being united under one nation.
And Emily Liska, let's close with you. As you said a few moments ago, you would like to raise some funds to tell the history more fully. Hopefully someone listening might help out with that.
It's our job to tell the story, our local history story, and this is a huge piece of that story, and in fact an integral part. If not for Jackson's commission to come to Florida and take Florida from Spain, and it was in an arrangement, in a deal, we would likely have no Jacksonville as we know it today.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. We thank you both so much for joining us. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
We were joined by Emily Liska, Executive Director of the Jacksonville Historical Society, and Sierra Taylor with the activist group The Dream Defenders. Much more still ahead. Later, best-selling author Marja Mills on her unlikely friendship with the great Harper Lee. But up next, a new study looks at the dangers of texting while driving. That's right after this.
On the next reveal, a doctor who has to act like a detective just to treat his patients.
They were careful encounters, always sworn to secrecy.
Tracking down the trade secrets behind sick workers at the most innovative high-tech companies in the world. That's on the next reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
WJCT's new weekend programs are here. Tune in to 89.9 Saturday and Sunday for brand new shows and old favorites at a new time. Join us for True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour, live comedy and music on Wits, and Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Learn more and see the new schedule at wjct.org/weekends.
Welcome back. Well, texting while driving has become a growing public safety concern. More than half of the states in the U.S. have laws prohibiting the practice. In Florida, you can't be pulled over if you're texting while driving, but you might get a ticket if you're pulled over for something else. It's a secondary offense. Research shows that treating texting and driving as a secondary offense, though, hasn't been very effective. Several Florida bills recently have proposed making texting behind the wheel a primary offense. You could get pulled over if the officer even suspects you're doing it. This spring, the sociology research team at Flagler College conducted some research around this phenomenon. Professor Casey Welch joins us now, along with students Patricia Marquez and Ruby Studevant. Thanks all for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
All right, Casey Welch, let's begin with you. You conducted some interviews and did some focus groups on texting while driving. What did you find?
Well, we found a lot. The data is extensive. We did the interviews and the focus groups, both qualitative research methods, found some interesting relationships between those who support more regulations but still admit to texting while driving. I think Patricia can actually address those numbers.
Yes, we actually have, like, out of 28 people, 24 of them, they were supporting the having a stronger, a stricter regulation. And out of those 24 people, 20 of them admitted that they text while driving.
Really? So people think it's bad, but they do it anyway?
Yes, they do.
And is that because they know that the penalties aren't too stiff for it?
Well, actually, we find a wide range of reasons, and they have strategies, and they think that maybe if they don't text immediately, they're going to appear to be rude or something, or they're going to forget to text back. So they still do it. And they have risk reductions. They do, if there's a less busy street, or if there's the speed limit under 20 or 40. And also we have contradictions. Some people said if I'm on the highway and I'm driving, and because it's a steady speed limit, I'm going to text while driving. But some other people are if I'm driving on the highway, I'm not going to text while driving.
And there's some age and gender differences too, Ruby, in how people look at this. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. But the gender differences weren't as significant as we think. There were a few age implications. The younger generations and the 65 and older generations were different. For instance, the younger generations were more likely to text while drive and admit to text while drive, as well as the middle-aged range.
But not people 60 plus.
No, ma'am. But they, 40.
Yeah, middle-aged people.
Yes, ma'am.
Those really old people. Yes. Casey Welch, there have been several efforts in the legislature to make this a primary offense, but they've never passed. There's always been resistance. Why is that?
I have no idea what happens. They die in committee. There have been probably over a dozen in the past 4 years, including this. There were four. Both in the House and in the Senate, trying to make it a primary offense, as well as some other ones trying to make it enhanced offenses for doing it in school zones. All of them die in committee.
But the data shows that when states pass it, a tougher measure, the roads get safer. Isn't that right?
The data is not consistent.
It's not consistent right on that.
It's consistent that texting while driving does distract drivers and that their capabilities become worse at driving in simulations. Whether it has a statewide reduction in accidents is unclear.
So what's the main takeaway, would you say, from this study? It's an interesting look at people's attitudes in Florida about this.
Well, what I can say with our findings, like I said before, a lot of people do admit texting while driving. And they do want, according to our data, they do want a stronger regulations. But what we were talking about is like maybe if the law is like aimed to more like reducing risk, because that was one like the main reason they were talking about, like they want a stronger regulation because it causes so many accidents. So maybe if the law is aimed to reducing the accidents rather than eliminating texting while driving, that will actually be better and people will be more supportive of it.
Interesting. Great, fascinating study, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you. You're absolutely welcome.
Casey Welch with Flagler College Sociology Department and his students Ruby Studevan and Patricia Marquez joining us. And we're back in a moment.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through July 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas. Des Moines. Topeka.
Montana. Cleveland. San Francisco. Denver.
Philadelphia. Minneapolis. Miami.
Colorado. Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News. Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, Shark Week comes to Mayport this Friday night as Aqua Jacks invites you to a fun-filled cruise along the St. John's River. It's aboard the Victory Casino Cruise, and hopping aboard is a way to help Aqua Jacks with its mission to bring a world-class aquarium to downtown Jacksonville. Aqua Jacks co-founder Dean Pfeiffer is here now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. So we'll talk about the event and Shark Week in a moment. But first, let's bring people up to date on the efforts of Aqua Jacks. It's your vision to place an aquarium right on the riverbank in downtown Jacks, correct?
That's correct. And co-founder is J.J. Hammond. Dean set this up. Good morning. Thank you for having me. Yes, we are.
Go ahead. Sorry.
we are... Right where we want to be, we're completing the feasibility study, and we're very pleased with the executive summary that we received. It's gone through a couple of drafts, but we are right now dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and we are well on the way to making this happen.
And you see this as a tourist attraction. You want to partner with the Jacksonville Zoo on this as well.
That's correct. It will be operated by the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens as a sister facility. And they certainly have been very instrumental in making this happen. And once it's up and running, they will take charge of it, and we look forward to it being an event or venue that will be well received to the Northeast Florida and Southeast Georgia region.
It's an ambitious undertaking to build this beautiful big aquarium on the North Bank. What's your fundraising target?
Fundraising targets, we certainly, hopefully after the feasibility study comes out, that we will embark on our capital funds campaign, hopefully by the end of the year. But right now we're focusing on getting that feasibility study out.
And how do you envision this aquarium fitting in with the plans that Jaguars owner Shad Khan has for that adjacent shipyards property on the North Bank?
We see it fitting in very well. We see it actually supplying the numbers of individuals that will make any project in that area in downtown Jacksonville very successful.
So with all of that said, let's talk about Friday night. There's going to be a river cruise in conjunction with Shark Week, which has become a huge thing in America.
It certainly has.
Let's talk about Friday night. What's going to be happening?
Yes, we're very excited about this. We've partnered with Victory Casino Cruises out of Mayport, and they're doing a special cruise for us for $20, which is normally a $35 value. You get your boarding pass, you get dinner on board, a welcome aboard drink, and you get to play the slots and just have fun. And most important, this is going to help support the aquarium project. Portions of the proceeds from Friday night will go toward the aquarium project. And we just want to take this opportunity to get together with all of our supporters and have them come out and have a good time with us.
Now, aboard, you're going to have a fantastic Shark Talk presentation provided by Living Color Aquariums, a.k.a. TV's Fish Tank Kings, directly from the adventurers that have studied sharks all over the globe for Discovery Channel's Shark Week. That sounds pretty interesting.
It is. We did a walkthrough yesterday down at the Victory Casino Cruise offices. Living Color has already set up an aquarium in the office, and it is absolutely beautiful. They are based out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and they've done and design and build for aquariums all over the United States and the world, SeaWorld, Disney World, Universal Studios, you name it. If you've seen an aquarium down there, it probably was done by Living Color Aquariums.
And the boarding fee is not too steep, $10?
$20.
$20, but some of that money will go toward the aquarium cause.
Absolutely. Again, it's $20, and it's normally $35, but they're doing a special for us for $20, so come out and join us.
That's right. It's Aqua Jax's celebration of Shark Week this Friday night, July 10th, aboard the Victory Casino Cruise, all to help fundraise for that downtown Jacksonville Aquarium. Tickets now at aquajax.net. And have a great cruise. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Come out and join us.
And we're back in a moment with New York Times bestselling author Marja Mills.
Hey, it's John Moe, the host of Wits, a new show recorded live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. Some of the top names in comedy and music join us each week for sketches.
You are so far outside the box right now, you are back in the box.
Music.
I'm out of the game.
And life's big questions.
How's it going?
It's going great, man. This is a wonderful program.
Saturday night at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Do I sound gay?
Yes, I think you do sound gay. Not as much as I do, but...
On the next Fresh Air, David Thorpe talks about his new documentary, Do I Sound Gay?, which follows him as he tries to sound less gay while wondering why it's even become an issue for him. We'll also hear from one of the people he consults, speech pathologist Susan Sankin. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Do you have great memories of how public television and public radio have been a meaningful part of your life? Learning to read while watching Sesame Street or Zoom.
I've never heard of anything like that.
No kidding.
Do you remember listening to public radio in the back seat of your parents' car?
Maybe you just hit an armadillo.
If you've grown up with us, we want to know your story. Give us a call at 904-353-6388 today.
Ah, Silicon Valley, hotbed of innovation and product launches and conferences.
It could be easy for entrepreneurs to get lost into going to conferences and networking instead of focusing on their product and how to make that better.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Some people get to have all the fun, not next time on Marketplace from APN.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, she's a former Chicago Tribune reporter who traveled down to Monroeville, Alabama to do a story on the reclusive Harper Lee. Maria Mills never thought she would actually meet the famous author, but she did. And it was actually the beginning of a wonderful friendship. Mills tells her story in her book. It's the New York Times bestseller, now out in paperback. The Mockingbird Next Door, Life with Harper Lee. Maria Mills, a pleasure to have you on the show. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
So back in 2001, the Tribune sent you down to Alabama to do a story on Harper Lee. What was in your mindset when you first went down there to do that piece?
Well, that I was delighted to be going to her hometown, but certainly not that I expected to meet her or her sister. I knew both were private and had been so for many years. But because the library system had selected To Kill a Mockingbird, we thought it would still be interesting for readers to know more about their hometown of Monroeville, which, as Harper Lee says, is 100 miles from anywhere. It's well off the interstate. And so I was pleased just to have the chance to visit the town. I wrote Alice Lee, Alice Finch Lee, that middle name is familiar to readers of Mockingbird, to let her know that I would be in town and why. And then knocked on their door shortly before I would be leaving, and was surprised that she invited me in. She had read the letter, and she and her sister both had been such supporters of libraries over the years, and were interested to know more about who I talked to in town and what was happening in Chicago, and that ended up being the first of so many conversations over the years.
Right, and it's incredible to read that you befriended Harper, also known as Nell, and her sister Alice, who's since passed on, and you actually ended up renting a house right next door. Why do you
with their blessing?
Yeah, how do you?
Well,
think?
In fact, I asked them when a friend suggested a house. I was looking for a place to live. This was after my story had run. They liked the story. I'd known them about 3 years at that point, and the daily newspaper schedule for me with lupus, which is an autoimmune condition that was causing problems, was no longer workable. But I thought I talked to them about the possibility of spending time down there to look at a book. And when a friend of theirs suggested a house that was just two doors down, I did say to them, "This it might be awfully close for comfort. I won't even inquire if you'd rather have a little more space." But they encouraged me to look, and I ended up renting the house actually right next door. With their blessing, I rented that house for 18 months. So I was there from the fall of 2004 until the spring of 2006. And that proximity really was a gift. One of my favorite things was just to hear Nell Harper call me next door, and I'd hear this husky voice say, "You pouring?" Didn't usually even say hello, just, "You pouring?" Meaning, "Do you have a pot of coffee on? Could I come over and we'll sat around the kitchen table?" We, as a friend of mine said, you drank dark oceans of coffee those years. Do you like to stop at McDonald's? And for me as a journalist, it was a privilege to have the chance to know them in that context of their daily lives and to know their friends and family there and spend time with them. It was just, I mean, they were just so extraordinarily generous with their time and with their insights into that area. It was remarkable.
How do you think you were able to gain their trust? There have been so many that have wanted to meet Harper Lee, interview her, and she, of course, for decades now, has lived a very private life. You were able to forge a friendship in a unique sort of way. How did that? What do you think it was about your approach that made you different?
Well, some of it I think was just was timing. They were in their later years. I think some of it too had to do with by the time I was living next door, we'd known each other, as I mentioned, for 3 years, had spent quite a bit of time on this newspaper profile that I wrote, that was a long profile that they said they were pleased with. They knew that those things they had asked to remain off the record did, and that I was careful in my reporting and so on. And then I think it just kind of grew from there. I think partly for Nell Harper, it was a time when there were a couple of movies about Truman Capote. I don't know if you remember when one movie with Philip Seymour Hoffman as Truman Capote, and then Catherine Keener playing the role of Nell. There were two movies in the works about the time they spent together in Kansas working on what became Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, nonfiction novel, as he called it, about farmhouse murders in Kansas. There was also the first major biography of Nell was in the works, and there was apprehension involved in all of that for her. There were times when she would get wind of something that was, she had heard about one of the movies or the biography in progress, and would say, would want to make sure that I had what she had to say about that topic straight. She had a way of kind of pointing her index finger and, you know, crooking her index finger and kind of making a point, you know, and she would sometimes say, now you put that in there, meaning include that, or would talk about something, but say, but, you know, that's off the record, and I would make a note of that. So partly it was in that context, I think, that it all unfolded. My editor had asked me to ask that question of friends of theirs to include in my books, and it is a question people have had. And he gave a number of reasons why he thought that had happened, but he said, you know, you let the river flow, meaning it was something that I think kind of took its own course at its own pace.
Huh.
And we had the luxury of time that is unusual, certainly, for journalists these days.
Right. You know, at the beginning of this program, the beginning of the hour, we talked about the hashtag Black Lives Matter going up on Confederate monuments all over the South and that whole movement. Of course, To Kill a Mockingbird is an American classic, looking at the injustices of Jim Crow. How do you think Harper Lee Nell looks at the way history has progressed in this country when it comes to the issue of civil rights? Because, of course, what she had to say about it is seen as so incredibly important.
Well, you know, I remember I talked with her and also with a longtime Lee family friend, Thomas Lane Butts, who's a minister who was involved in civil rights early on, was the minister at their Methodist church for some time, as well as many others. And both of them remarked on the idea that some of those changes, when you look back to certainly the days of segregation and even what was happening in the 50s and 60s, talked about being thankful that those changes had come about, and that in some cases maybe came about more quickly than people at the time thought they might, but also talked about progress that's yet to be made and some of the social, the fact that you can change laws, but sometimes changing attitudes and social mores, it takes longer. That can't be legislated as much. So I think it was a mixed view, appreciating what had changed that needed to change, and aware that more still needed to. I know that in Monroeville, Alice Lee, in particular, Nell Harper's older sister and attorney, who she called Atticus in a skirt. Who practiced law very much in the mold, had practiced with their father, who was the inspiration for the Atticus Finch character. And she was somebody, it really struck me, who worked behind the scenes. I think as somebody growing up in Wisconsin, I always, you know, you would read more about people involved in civil rights, read more about the people who marched and were on the front lines, and certainly those delivering speeches. And one thing I really got an appreciation of from both of the Lees was all that went on behind the scenes, quietly. I think Alice Lee was somebody who particularly did that in her involvement both with the law and with the Methodist Church, and Nell Harper as well.
And
we're often quiet behind the scenes. And I think sometimes if you're willing to do things anonymously, in fact prefer to do them that way, you can get a good deal accomplished as well.
Sure. So as you look back on your time with her, what are the most What is the most fond memory you have of
Nell? Oh, there are so many. I couldn't possibly list one. But one of the things that struck me early on, and it never changed, was their sense of fun with both of them. And I think because Nell Harper has been known to be so private all these years, that isn't necessarily what would pop into your mind, I think. And yet, that was evident from the beginning. She loved to get behind the wheel of her Buick and go exploring, often with Alice, and when I was living there, me, in tow. And, sometimes they would be in search of something they remembered from their childhood. And if they got lost, all the better. It was, it was an adventure that would be a story that would told around kitchen tables.
Well, it's an adventure to read. We're actually running out of time, but I encourage everyone to read this adventure of a book because it's remarkable. Maria Mills, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, a pleasure. A pleasure.
She's
thank you.
New York Times bestselling author Maria Mills. The book is now out in paperback. The New York Times bestseller, The Mockingbird Next Door, Life with Harper Lee. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Next on Diane Rehm, sex offender registries are designed to protect the public from pedophiles and others who've committed sexual crimes. But some say those guilty of much lesser offenses shouldn't be on the list. Sex offender registries and calls for reform. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.